everybody. It's great to be in Flower Mound. How's this? Good? Great. It's so great to be with you all, and I'm so excited to get to journey with you all these next 6 weeks. We're going to have a lot of fun. I hope that you have come with questions, and I told the bishop that if I don't know the answer, we're going to call him. I'm going to phone a friend, which actually we did this series. Do you think we could turn that down a little bit? A little bit? Is that better? I did a talk in Los Angeles to a group of Scientologists, actually, and we were speaking on the topic of who is Jesus and how do we know he was and is God. And I had the phone right up front, and I said, Bishop, you better be by that phone. I said, because I'm calling you. And we didn't need to call him, but I did call on a couple of friends in the audience. So I might do that. I might call on some of you if I don't know the answer to pass it on. But you know I love being here at St. Nicholas. This is one of my favorite churches. And I think one of my favorite things about it is just driving through the city, getting out, and then going through the neighborhood, and then just coming into this place of beauty. So thank you all for having me. So this is going to be a treat for me. So as I was preparing for this series of talks, I was reminded of a story that a friend of mine absolutely loves to tell. He loves his stories, a friend of mine in England. And he talks about a story of two men who had joined the army. And after they had done their basic training, they had gone through all the rigor, they were given their first leave. And so they head out to the nearest town, and they go to the nearest bar, and they drink and drink and drink all night long, and they keep drinking into the night, and eventually it's closing time, and they get thrown out. Now, while they have been drinking inside, a fog had come into the town. And it was so thick when they stepped out, it was just this pea soup dense fog, and they couldn't even see where they were. So they were trying to make their way back through the darkness to the base. And they were completely lost. And as they were walking, they eventually bumped into this man who was actually their commander. But they didn't know it was their commander because they were so drunk and they didn't even recognize him. And they were so lost, and they said, let's ask this guy where we are. So they go up to the guy, and he begins to kind of puff up and pulls back his coat to show the braiding on his chest. And they said, excuse me, do you know where we are? And he stands and looks at them and he says, do you know who I am? And they look at each other. The first soldier turns to the second and said, now we're in big trouble. We don't know where we are. And this guy doesn't even know who he is. Now, many people have said that the culture in which we live is one which has now become so thoroughly confused and so postmodern that we feel confused on two basic questions. We're not sure where we are anymore, and at times we're not even sure who we are. And if we don't know who we are and we don't know where we are, it's very hard to figure out where we are going in life. And we're so busy, as Father Mark said. He started off saying we're so busy with our lives. By the way, Father Mark, I found out, I know you changed the choir time tonight, so we know the choir's here. I am preaching to the choir tonight. I'm literally preaching to the choir. But we are so busy, and we're so inundated with all sorts of information, literally at our fingertips, buzzing in our pockets at all hours of the day and night. We experience all sorts of pushes and pulls and competing voices that will tell us what will make us happy. Do you know the average American sees or is bombarded with 1,400 pieces of advertising in any given day? And all of that is saying, buy this. This will make you happy. Do this. Do this. And just pulling at us. And these competing voices often, if we take time to really think about it, are sharing with us different worldviews, completely different perspectives on who we are, what we should be doing with our time, and what we should be doing with our lives. And we're totally bombarded with these different worldviews. Now, in these next 5 weeks, we're going to embark on a journey together and explore some of these fundamental questions of life and look at the Christian response. But as we begin, I just need you all to know, and this is why I need to have a phone a friend to the bishop, that I'm not a theologian, I'm not ordained, I'm a lay person who just has been captivated by Jesus Christ. And for a long time, I did not believe in him at all. In fact, in college, I was frequently debated Christians, and I was on the side of the atheists. And the Christians, when I became a Christian and began to explore it and then surrender my life to Jesus, I wrote a couple of the Christians I used to debate and said, "You're never going to believe this. I became a Christian." And they wrote back and said, "We knew you would, because you were so eager in searching for the truth. We knew you'd get there eventually." But my life has totally changed by not only my heart being changed in giving my life to Christ, and I'll share a little more of my story and what that has looked like in my own journey in the coming weeks. But also my mind has been surrendered to Christ. And so I knew that I experienced a peace and an unconditional love that I never knew before. But I said, "Gosh, I've had this experience. Is this really God? And is this Jesus? And who is Jesus? And these Christians are saying he rose from the dead. How do we know he rose from the dead?" And I set off for England at Oxford and to study. And a friend of mine said, "Well, you know, what if you get there and you do all this research on evidence for the resurrection and the reliability of the Bible and some key questions, and what if you realize it's not true?" And I said, "Fine, then I'll just live the life the way I want to live it." I said, "But what I want to do is find the truth and then set on that path." And so what I found there when I got there, the more I studied and the deeper I dug, was that truth is a person. And this person is embodied in the person of Jesus. We're going to explore this. And I said, for the rest of my life, I want to share this hope and forgiveness and unconditional love with as many people as I can. So we have such amazing news to share of the transformative life that God has for us. And it's hard to keep it a secret. So I've dedicated my life to doing talks like these for us to explore together. But we're gonna look at some of the key questions. And underneath a lot of these questions are questions of, who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? Does it matter? Do I matter to God? Is there a God? Does God care? How then shall I live out the days of my life? Now this week we're gonna look at the fundamental question of, does God exist at all? And how do we even begin to unpack that and see him? Next week, we're going to look at the figure of Jesus Christ, what makes him unique, why Christians affirm that he was and is God, and how do we decipher and say that Jesus is unlike any other religious figure in the world? How many people have heard all paths lead to God, and doesn't matter which path you're on, we'll all get there. And, well, Jesus, you can believe Jesus, or you can exercise, or you can believe Muhammad or follow Buddha. It's all the same. So we're going to look at what makes Jesus unlike any other. The next week, we're going to work to make sense of suffering. If God is good, why is there so much suffering? Why is there so much suffering in my own life? And when I go through suffering, why does it feel like God isn't there sometimes? Is he there? Has he taken his hand off my life? How do I make sense of this suffering? Then the next week, well, okay, we've got a couple options. We can look at the evidence for the resurrection. I'm going to let y'all vote. Or we can look at the concept of truth. People say, you know, your truth, my truth, all the truth is the same. So we'll decide what. Anyway, I'll give y'all some options. We'll vote and see which topic. The next week, we're going to look at, can we trust the Bible? Well, the Christian faith is our primary sources of the Christian faith is the Bible. Can we trust it? Can we trust those texts? Have they been tampered with? When was it constructed? Does the Da Vinci Code have it right? Or do our church leaders in our faith tradition, do they have it? You know, and looking at, can we trust the Bible? And then the last week we're going to talk about how do we begin to just share our faith with others in our contemporary culture in this spiritual landscape. Now, many of us here have looked into these questions and embraced the reality of the Christian faith and what it offers and said, this is the most plausible answer to my life questions. And I don't know about you all, I know, you know, that God gives us all these windows of opportunities at the coffee machine, at the workplace, or around the dinner table with your family, or on the phone with a friend, or at the mailbox with your neighbor, and a question is raised about God or a comment, and you freeze. And then you go to bed at night and you think, oh, I wish I had said this, and I could have given a word of hope, or I could have offered a prayer, and I froze. Well, I hope that the next few weeks will bolster your faith and hopefully provide, maybe you'll walk away with a toolkit and some tools to be able to answer some of those questions when you're given the opportunity to. And we could spend years on each one of these. We're painting in very broad brush strokes, but these will give us sketches and allow us to begin to delve in. What we're engaging in is called apologetics. And so the bishop even asked me today, I said, I'm going up to Flower Mound. We're going to do some apologetics. He said, what are you apologizing for again? And he was joking. But the term apologetics actually stems from the Greek word, which means a reasoned defense. And all Christians are called to engage in apologetics on some level, a very basic level. St. Peter, in his letter to the persecuted church, said, but in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you for the reason for the hope that you have. But do it, and this is key, isn't it? But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience. Do it with gentleness and respect. So as Christians, we have a great joy and opportunity to share the reason for the hope that we have. And I often think that many times skeptics look at Christians. I mean, I have had friends who, when I say, well, I've become a Christian, they just look at me like, you've got to be kidding me. And it's almost like, well, bless your little heart, you know, like, oh, you found a crutch for the things that pain you or stress, or you found this wonderful crutch, and they, or gosh, you've eaten the candy bar or something like that, or drunk the wrong Kool-Aid or something. And it's seen as this crutch. And it's seen as blind faith, kind of stepping into this abyss of wishful thinking or positive self-help or something like that. But the Christian faith has never viewed faith in this light. We've never asked anyone to believe in a blind fashion. In fact, quite the opposite is true. Christianity affirms that God has not only given us clues to the reality of who He is, but the Christianity affirms that God has revealed Himself to us, that He came to earth and He walked among us. So faith for Christians, He entered into history, into time and space. So for Christians, faith is not a step in the dark. It is actually a step into ultimate reality. It is the most real thing in the world, and we can know the truth. And as our scripture says, in the truth will set us free. Now, and what is belief, Greg? He was giving me the definition of belief the other day.
In the Greek, the New Testament, it literally means to trust, to commit to put your weight down on.
Put your weight down on. So it's not blind, like a stepping into the dark. It's actually to put all your weight on it. Many of us have embraced this faith, and this class will provide tools, but perhaps you've come tonight with questions, and you've got lots of them, and you're skeptical about Christianity. We are so glad you are here. Come with your questions, and if you're a member of this church, invite your friends Invite your coworkers, invite your family members, invite your teenagers. Invite them because they can come and ask any question they want, and we welcome you. We welcome you. This is a place where we can explore these questions. So let us begin with the first question. Are y'all ready? Oh, good. I was wondering if there were markers. Before we can look into the primary Christian claim that Jesus was and is the Son of God, let's step back at the beginning and say, is there evidence for the existence of God at all? Now, when I shared that I was speaking on this topic, I had people kind of say, well, of course, everyone knows God exists. And I think something like over 90% of Americans believe that God exists. We also see this in other parts of the world. But let me just say, having lived in England for 3 years, atheism is very much on the rise. And a movement, and particularly it's become quite popular with Christopher Hitchens and some of these other speakers saying, no, God doesn't exist. And they're offering an alternative perspective. So we're gonna look into this. People have had different views on God's existence and its implications for centuries. Here are some of them. Oxford professor of chemistry Peter Atkins, echoing his atheistic colleague Richard Dawkins. Have any of y'all read Richard Dawkins, some of his stuff? He said this. He said, the human race must realize how insignificant it is. We are just a bit of slime on a planet belonging to the sun. In his book, The Existence of God, philosopher Richard Swinburne wrote, the experience of so many men in their moments of religious vision corroborates what nature and history show to be quite likely, that there is a God who made and sustains the universe. Bernard Williams, in his book Ethics and the Limits of Philosophy, noted, if God exists, the arguments about him are arguments about the cosmos and are of cosmic importance. But if he does not, they are about nothing. In that case, the important questions must be about human beings and why, for instance, they ever believed God existed. Abraham Lincoln stated, I can see how it might be possible for a man to look upon the earth and be an atheist. But I cannot conceive how he can look up into the heavens and say there is no God. And last but not least, one of America's greatest philosophers, Woody Allen, said, what if everything is an illusion and nothing exists? In that case, I've definitely overpaid for my carpet. So, is there evidence for the existence of God? Unequivocally, yes. Can we prove the existence of God? No, but we can know it to be true. The fact of the matter is, are there any mathematicians here? Engineers? Scientists? Okay. As you know, the fact is, there are very few things in this world we can actually prove. And most of it is mathematical. In order to prove something, you have to have anterior knowledge. So, for example, in order to prove that 2 plus 2 equals 4, you have to have a concept of number. So refuters of the existence of God, made popular these days by Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, all those guys, claim that God does not exist because there's insufficient evidence. Dawkins and his fellow skeptics use what is called a method of strong rationalism that proposes that one should not believe in something unless it can be proven rationally, logically, and empirically. Proof under these kinds of circumstances calls for an argument to be so watertight that no one who has logical faculties could reject it. They want this kind of proof for the existence of God. Many have noted this is not only impossible because so few things can actually be proven, as I said, most of it is mathematical, their argument collapses on itself. Why? Because one cannot empirically prove that no one should believe something without empirical proof. So it collapses in on itself. I can remember one night watching a debate between Alistair McGrath, he's one of our great Anglican theologians. It was live, it was so electric, it was so exciting. And Richard Dawkins, and he was arguing against the existence of God, and Alistair McGrath was arguing for the existence of God. And both were asserting a belief. Both were clearly asserting a belief, and I thought McGrath had so much more evidence that he was actually just shredding Dawkins. But they were all basing it on their beliefs. It was a great night. How do we come to any conclusions about this world? We apply what C.S. Lewis calls critical reasoning. Science uses this kind of inductive reasoning. Perhaps we cannot prove something, but we are given strong reason to suppose. And from this strong reason to suppose, we can claim with sufficient certainty that something is true. So I'm not a scientist, but from what I know, one states a hypothesis, observes to see if this hypothesis stands the test, and observes from the evidence and then forms a conclusion. Now, of course, the conclusion can be altered if the evidence begins to disprove itself, right? So, for example, before any English people had gone to New Zealand, they believed that all swans were white. So when they talked about swans, everyone just assumed a swan is a large white bird. Then they went to New Zealand, and they saw black swans. So they had to alter their definition of swans. So we base our conclusions on observation and on accumulated evidence. So I can't prove that my mom loved me, but I know it to be true. More than anything else, she's now passed away. But if I think of one thing I know to be true in this world, is that my mom loved me with all that she had. How? She told me. She showed me day in and day out by her love. She supported me in every way. She went through seventh grade with me, where I cried every day. That is love. That is love. So I can't prove it in a watertight argument, but I know it to be true more than anything else. So can we prove God exists? No, not in a watertight argument. But can we know it to be true? I would say yes. Now, what we're about to look at are not proofs. They're pointers. And there are a number of philosophers, theologians, and scientists such as Alvin Plantinga of Notre Dame and Richard Swinburne and Peter Kraft of Boston College, who was here with us in the diocese a couple of years ago, who literally go through over 20 reasons and pointers for the existence of God. You'll be happy to know we're just going to look at seven tonight. So we're going to look at seven. So these are seven that you can put in your toolkit. Is everyone ready? I just think this is so much fun. Okay. Number one is the fact of the world. The fact of the world. Philosopher Martin Heidegger asked, why is there something instead of nothing? Isn't it staggering that the world even exists at all? The first pointer to the existence of God is the fact that the world exists. And the existence of the world begs the question, what or whom created the world? How did it happen? Well-respected scientist Stephen Hawking wrote, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. One of the country's leading geneticists, Francis Collins, who is now head of the National Genome Project, says this in his book, The Language of God. He says, we have this very solid conclusion that the universe had an origin, the Big Bang, 15 billion years ago. The universe began with an unimaginably bright flash of energy from an infinitesimally small point. That implies that before that, there was nothing. I can't imagine how nature, in this case the universe, could have created itself. And the very fact that the universe had a beginning implies that someone was able to begin it. And it seemed to me to be outside of nature. Hawking concluded, it would be very difficult to explain why the universe would have begun in just this way, except as the act of God who intended it to create beings like us. Isn't that absolutely staggering? This has been called the fine-tuning or the anthropic principle. The great particle physicist at Cambridge University, John Polkinghorne, argues that in order for life to exist, the conditions needed for the universe to occur, this is a quotation, are within a very tight range of values for many physical constants such as the speed of light, the gravitational constant, the strength of the weak and strong nuclear forces, I don't know what any of this means, but we'll go with it, must have values that fall together into an extremely narrow range. If any one of those constants was off by even one part in a million, or in some cases by one part in a million million, the universe could not have actually come to the point where matter would have been able to coalesce. That is mind-blowing. It would have been impossible for galaxies, stars, planets, or people to exist if one constant had been off. So perhaps one says, well, I see your point, but it still all comes down to blind chance. Okay, let's explore this for a bit. The naturalists, the atheists say it's all blind chance. Let's suppose for a moment that everything on the earth is the result of blind chance. The world's existence is based on random happenstance. How is it that from a random beginning came an entire world based on cause and effect? Doesn't this question possibly point to the fact that there must have been a cause to begin the universe? Could it have happened randomly, or was there a creator behind it? It's unlikely that something random could create an entire system based on cause and effect. There is a cause for everything in this world. So someone might say, well, God's not necessary for the world to exist. My question, and the scientist's question, is how is it that the world had those properties in the first place? Where did the properties found in the Big Bang come from? Dawkins and others say that the beginning of the world is a result of chance plus necessity. The Christian response is, where does this necessity come from? The fact of the universe points to an ultimate cause. St. Paul said, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. It's clearly seen here. Being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave him thanks. So Paul is saying, look at the world around you. This is God's creation. It's evident. Okay, the second one is, hey y'all, don't worry, we are going to end on time. It's like, oh no, we're just on point two. We're going to roll through this. Personhood. Human beings are not robots or tailor dummies. What makes us different from an ape or a fly? What about human reason and human creativity and personality? I'm from East Texas. Only God could create some of those personalities. So the atheist is like, how can the impersonal create the personal? How could the mind have come from cold matter? How is it that we are so passionate on life and love and the ability to play and laugh, but come from cold matter? There's a great philosopher who said one of the greatest evidence for the existence of God is, Peter Berger said this, is that we can play. That we can play and time is suspended, that human beings can play. Could all that come from cold matter? How is it that we have intelligence? Could our intelligence have come from the unintelligent? If our ability to reason comes from irrational matter, what then should be our reference point for logic? Isn't it rational to believe that we could have come from a supreme intelligence, a personal source we call God? Our ability to reason, imagine, create, love, make decisions points to the existence of the ultimate intelligence. St. Augustine argued, this is really interesting to me, St. Augustine argued that the fact that our limited minds can discover eternal truth about being, that the truth and understanding of truth resides in the mind, but the human mind is not eternal, points to the fact that there must exist an eternal mind in which these truths reside. Bottom line is, our tiny minds point to the mind of God. That doesn't work. Third, values. Values, values. Where do the values we cherish come from, such as truth and beauty and goodness and creativity and love? Do they come just from within ourselves? And why do we all value them? Granted, in different ways, in different cultures, we value different things. Y'all value the crawfish boils and other things. I mean, we value different things. But there does seem to be a lot of common ground. If there is a creator God, then our values make sense. They are planted within us by God, the supreme value. And each of them sheds light onto aspects of his nature. Otherwise, it's a curious question. Where do these values come from? Where do they come from? Values are yet another pointer to the ultimate author of values. Love is a perfect example. A materialist would say it comes from purely scientific impulse. Now, suggestion for you men. You do not want to go to your wife and give her flowers and tell her you love her and say, I would avoid saying this, I'm having a surge of neurological impulses, which now force me to say I love you. That's probably not the way you want to go. And that's probably not the way, the root of love, is it? We intuitively respond to the value of beauty. Peter Kraft says, you know, gosh, you know, we can know God exists from an aesthetic experience. He said, listen to Bach or tasting a fine wine. There must be God. You either get this or you don't. Think of a sunset, the beauty of this place. The poet Gerard Manley Hopkins put it this way. He said, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. I love that. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. Okay, fourth. See, we're moving along, y'all. Conscience. We all have one. I'm fascinated. My 2-year-old and 4-year-old niece and nephew were with me all weekend. And I started to know, they've got this intuitive sense of right and wrong. Now they push the limits on it. But they have this intuitive sense. We all have one. Every human being have a sense of right and wrong. Granted that some people's consciences and notions of right and wrong have been twisted by the world, yet all human beings seem to have this instinctive sense of ought. I ought to do this. I ought to have done that. Where does that come from? Where does that come from? Could it not possibly be the moral law within our hearts which points to the supreme moral lawgiver? Now, some people have argued that morality is merely a product of social conditioning, or it's a product of survival of the fittest. However, if you think of our greatest moral advances, the liberation of slaves, for example, have come from people who were going against the grain of society. If morality is governed by survival of the fittest, what accounts for voluntary sacrifice for the survival of another? The moral compass within us points to a moral lawgiver. Fifth, this is one of my favorites, religion. Religion. My dad talks about he went to the Soviet Union when it was communist. And he went to St. Petersburg, and he said all the crosses had been taken off the buildings. And then he went back after the fall of communism and said, you go back to St. Petersburg, and it's like crosses everywhere, and it's just glorious. Wherever you go, in every culture, there's a belief in God and a deep, deep desire to worship. Why is there a concept of God in the first place? Why is it that humans have this instinct to worship something beyond themselves? Now, this instinct, this desire to worship takes many shapes and forms. It can become really twisted, of worship of pop stars or sports teams. None of us in Texas have that problem. To be sure, it's an instinct that can't be squelched in any way. Communism tried to, but it can't. C.S. Lewis summarizes this really well. He says, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for these desires exists. A baby feels hunger. There's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. There's such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. We seek something above and beyond the material world. We seek God. St. Augustine says it this way. I love this. He says, our hearts, he says, you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until we find rest in thee. I love that. And last but not least, this is for next week. Anyone take a guess? The most convincing evidence for the existence of God is the fact that Christians throughout the century have testified to that God himself came to earth. The best evidence for the existence of God is the person of Jesus Christ, who claimed to be God. God did not reveal himself in some great majesty. He revealed himself in a way that human beings could digest and understand. God became man, and he entered into our world. The Gospels clearly assert and affirm, and history testifies to the fact that God came to earth, and he walked among us, he taught us, he showed us how to live, and then he died for us on the cross, suffering a most brutal death, so that we could be cleansed and forgiven and have union with God, the relationship that we were made for from the beginning of time. This is the greatest evidence for the existence of God. John 1:18 says this, no one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known. It takes God to reveal God. And I love this. St. Paul, in his letter to the church at Colossae, wrote this about Jesus. He said this about Jesus. He said, he's the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn among the dead, so that in everything he must have supremacy. For God was pleased to have all the fullness of his deity dwell in him. And next week we're going to look at this amazing figure of Jesus Christ. And look at who God is. That not only does God exist, but God is a God of hope and power and justice and mercy and compassion and unconditional love. And he is to be known and wants to be known and wants us to know him more. Can we prove God exists? No. But tonight, after even looking at these first six pointers, and they're over 20, but that'd make it a long night, but I think that there are pointers that show us that God exists, and we begin to see his goodness. Oh, you know what one I forgot? The design of the world. The design of the world. Think of the intricacy of a leaf or the honing mechanism of a bat or the human body. Doesn't that point to a great designer, a phenomenal designer? So thank you all for listening, and we can open it up to questions. And it won't be so rigorous next week. We'll have a bit more fun. But gosh, I mean, for me to begin to dive into this basic question that I think all human beings have is, does God exist at all? And we all have moments. Boy, we have a firm faith to stand on. Thank y'all for sitting through week one. The next weeks are going to be real exciting, I promise. This is a little heady tonight, but I hope you enjoyed it.